Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, a panel of distinguished women studies scholars celebrate the 50th anniversary of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. Our moderator is Virginia Sapiro, professor of political science and dean of Boston University's College of Arts and Sciences, which presented tonight's event. Dean Sapiro.
I'm now very pleased to introduce the panel. I'm going to do it alphabetically because that's what's in front of me, and they will wave to indicate which one they are. So alphabetically, beginning with Eileen Boris, CLA 1970, is the Hull Professor and Chair of the Department of Feminist Studies and Professor of History and Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. At Boston University, she managed, in her own words, to graduate summa cum laude with distinction as a double major in American history and civilization and English language and literature, even though she was busy occupying Marsh Chapel and was there when Bill Baird broke the Massachusetts law on birth control. She's the prize-winning author of Home to Work, Motherhood, and the Politics of Industrial Homework in the U.S., which won the 1995 Philip Taft Prize in Labor History, and with Jennifer Klein, Caring for America, Home Health Workers in the Shadow of the Welfare State, which won the 2012 Sarah Whaley Prize in Women and Work from the National Women's Studies Association. Next, let me introduce Susan Reverby, who is the Marion Butler McLean Professor in the History of Ideas and Professor of Women's and Gender Studies at Wellesley College. She received her PhD from the American Studies Program at Boston University in 1982. While our program, she says, was once described as full of wives, that is, women who went to BU because they had husbands, partners in the Boston area, she writes, we turned out the third highest number of PhDs in women's history in the United States in the mid-1970s to early 1980s, and we all went on to various kinds of academic positions. Reverby was Wellesley's first hire into their women's studies program, half-time, 1 year to start, and 30 years later, it is a department with seven faculty and scores of majors. Next, we have Carol Rivers, professor of journalism in the Boston University College of Communication. Calm, folks. Woo-woo. She was the 2007 winner of the Helen Thomas Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of Professional Journalists. She is a nationally known author, journalist, columnist, and media critic, and has been reporting about and commenting on American life and politics for four decades. She is one of the famous girls in the balcony at the National Press Club in Washington, a reference to the fact that women reporters had to be in the balcony to cover speeches there, and there were no chairs, so they had to lean on the balcony to write. Carol interviewed Betty Friedan a number of times, and in fact, Betty Friedan hosted a book party in her New York apartment for Carol and her co-authors to celebrate the publication of their book Beyond Sugar and Spice, which was, of course, a feminist book. Carol's forthcoming book with Rosalind Barnett is The New Soft War Against Women, to be published by Penguin. Next, we have Roberta Salper, major who majored in Spanish at Boston University and graduated in August 1959. Her mentor at BU is Maria Luisa Osorio, who did not get tenure. The department then was all male. And Roberta is still in contact with Professora Osorio. Roberta then received master's and PhD degrees in the Department of Romance Languages and Literatures at Harvard University, started her academic career at the University of Pittsburgh in 1968, and became the first full-time faculty member in the nation's first women's studies program in 1970 at San Diego State University. She published one of the first anthologies in the women's liberation movement, Feminist Liberation, History, and Current Politics, published by Alfred Knopf in 1971. She's currently a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University and has just completed a memoir, Domestic Subversive. She has been a part-time instructor in the Spanish department at BU since 2005, and she loves BU students. And finally, I'm Gina Sapiro, the Dean of Arts and Sciences and a professor of political science, and for 31 years was a professor of political science and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I taught using various works by most of these people. My main connection to BU before arriving here was that in 1970, I was a sophomore at Clark University, and most of the universities in Massachusetts were shut down by strikes. I was the phone coordinator for our campus participation in a demonstration designed to stop the cars on the Mass Pike. I was the Worcester coordinator, and the main Boston coordinator at the other end of the phone line was, I don't know who, but it was a Boston University student. And like Eileen Boris, I was involved in one of the actions by Bill Baird in Worcester to try to help legalize contraception. So with that, let me welcome the panel, welcome you. And I'm going to ask my distinguished panelists just to go down the line and say their piece, and I will wrap it up.
I want to share two experiences in my life when the feminine mystique made a difference. During most of the 1960s, until 1968, I was living in Madrid, Spain, married to a Spanish Marxist, the son of a prominent and wealthy family of anti-fascists. Francisco Franco was the dictator of Spain between 1939 and 1975, and official and unofficial misogyny was ubiquitous. Along with my then husband, I became active in anti-fascist activities, some of them clandestine, and I learned and read about Marxism. I gave a speech in Madrid to the Spanish Association of University Women in 1967 on a topic of my choosing, and I said, the role of women in the American university. This is 1967. About which I knew very little, except that we were not equal to male academics. I wrote to the dean at Radcliffe, and she sent me Jesse Bernard's Academic Women, which was published in 1964, the only thing then, right? When I gave the speech, I define myself as a Marxist and a feminist, but not a particularly knowledgeable one. My first interaction with Betty Friedan came in preparation for that speech. I recalled that initial interaction with Betty Friedan in a memoir I've just finished, and I will share it with you. This is from the memoir. I had never met an American feminist, but I read Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique to prepare for the speech that I would deliver in April 1967 at Madrid's Institute. Although I recognized my mother's plight in Friedan's descriptions of married life in the 1950s, and I certainly shared some of the malaise Betty Friedan identified in her book, I did not know anyone else who did, and Friedan's analysis did not satisfy me. She talked about the illness with no name, that awful psychological oppression, the enormous frustration, anger, bitterness that lay just below the surface for countless women who had been socialized into believing that true women accepted secondary status in society. All of that certainly resonated with me, but the solutions she suggested was incomplete and did not go to the root of the problem. Her answer to combating male supremacist practices was to fight for certain reforms that amounted to getting men out of the way so as to make room for women. That is, freeing women from the institutionalized discrimination that maintained male dominance. Crucial reforms, to be sure, but Betty Friedan was talking about improving the lot of women like herself And I knew that middle-class women were only a part of the female population. I had seen what working-class poverty did to too many women in Spain to forget about them. Abolishing discrimination against women might open the way for a female head of state, a corporation president, and female generals, but a factory girl would remain a factory girl. A maid would remain a maid. It seemed to me that unless a woman's movement made changing the status of women like Juanita and Vicenta, the domestic workers in my ex-husband's parents' home, that I knew in Madrid, their status was as important as achieving more opportunities for my former upper-middle-class Spanish sister-in-law or for me in the United States. Unless the status was changed for all the classes, the fundamental causes of women's oppression would not be eliminated. But I knew, even then, that the arena where I would be most effective in promulgating progressive change for women would be in academia, among middle-class women. My roots were there, and the stimulus to revolt had sprung from this world. As I searched for more data for my lecture, I found there were practically no books that dealt with women in the university, a subject generally assumed to have little intrinsic, let alone market, value. Okay, that's the excerpt from this fascinating memoir. Okay.
But you'll all be able to buy some.
You can buy, yeah. No, it's not quite done, but it's called Domestic Service. It's done, but not published yet. Okay, my second interaction with the feminist mystique was in January 1969 when I co-taught the first women's studies course at the University of Pittsburgh. There were 58 young women and 2 young men in the course. The first class, I asked everyone to write a paragraph visualizing a day in their life when they were 55. 49 of the women said they would be married to a wonderful man with children. 4 said they would be grade school teachers, and the 2 males said professor or engineer. Then we read Feminine Mystique. Betty Friedan was the takeoff point for our journey together during that semester. For me, it was an exhilarating experience I'll never forget. So I'm grateful to Betty Friedan for her courage and intelligence. She was a singular American woman. Thank you.
Well, I must say that the first time I got what was called the click moment by feminists, the moment when you suddenly realized, holy smoke, you know, you've really been discriminated against, was indeed when I was one of the few women reporters sort of allowed to cover things in Washington. I was a young reporter, couldn't belong to the National Press Club, was one of the girls in the balcony. That means I had to go upstairs to the balcony, and while all the men sat down in their comfy chairs and I leaned on the, you know, the railing writing my stuff. And one day I was assigned to do a profile on Carl Roan, who's the first African-American head of the United States Information Agency. So he was giving a speech at the press club, and I followed him in, fully thinking I would just sort of sit right on the front table so I could take my notes. I was literally grabbed by 2 burly guys and practically half dragged up to the balcony. So there I was leaning over the balcony, and Carl Roan was giving his speech, and he talked about how as a boy in McMinnville, Tennessee, he could not sit on the first floor of the movie theater, but he and other African-American people were sent to the balcony. And I saw these white liberal reporters going, oh, and boy, did I have this click. Hey, guess where I am? I am in the balcony. And at that time, There was no woman editor of the newspaper. There was no woman bureau chief. There was no woman correspondent on television. The prospects for somebody like me who wanted to be a journalist, the doors were absolutely closed. You maybe could sort of sneak in and find a little spot somewhere, but there was no career path up there because women were just not supposed to do that. Maybe for a couple of years before you got married, but you really weren't supposed to do it. And so I really identified with Betty Friedan's dilemma because I looked around me and saw a lot of people who had dreams and ambitions and were told, you're absolutely, you know, it's either penis envy or you're, you know, somehow psychologically demented and what's wrong with you anyhow. And so I thought The Feminine Mystique was a very important book because it opened up a conversation that led to a movement that has been an amazing human rights movement. But if Betty were to come back today, I think she'd look around, she'd be pleased at 3 women on the Supreme Court and combat roles opening up for women, but she was a journalist, she'd look around and see, guess what? Things are not the way they should be. In fact, women are stalling out all over the place. And in the soft war, the new soft war against women, Dr. Roz Barnett and I are looking, and we look around, and it really surprises us the things that aren't happening. You know, women have made great gains in education. They're getting more PhDs, they're getting more education, but guess what? These things have not translated into money and influence. Women aren't getting to the top at anything like the rate you would have expected because of their education and early promise. They're doing great in college, but as they move up the ladder, they stall out. For example, in 2011, a typical college-educated woman, 25 years or older, working full-time, earned $50,000 a year compared to $70,000 a year for educated male workers of the same qualification in the same age group. It was $20,000 a year over a lifetime, $700,000 that this graduate is going to be down. Female graduates from Harvard learn 30% less than their male counterparts. Women's representation in corporate boardrooms and executive suites is shrinking. It's not growing, despite all this nonsense you've heard about the end of men. Absolute garbage. The head of the think tank Catalyst, Eileen Lang, said, "This is our fifth report where the annual change in female readership remained flat. If this trend line represented a patient's pulse, she'd be dead." Then there's one of my favorites, the mommy tax. It's interesting how you can be moving up the ladder and working and honored by your peers, and suddenly you have a child. Instantly your brain dies. People look at you and they say, you know, you're going to always want to be running home, you're not going to be committed to work, you're not going to be able to think, you're not going to be able to focus. And the interesting thing about the mommy tax is what's your lifetime loss of earning in terms of the rest of your life? In general, a college-educated woman has a child, she will lose about $1 million in lifetime earnings. $1 million, that's a lot. Interestingly enough, there's a fatherhood bonus. There's a motherhood tax and there's a fatherhood bonus. And what that means is that while mothers are looked upon as brain dead, when a man has a child, suddenly he's looked upon as responsible, not running around to do sex, drugs, and rock and roll. He's going to be a wonderful employee. And there's a terrific study out of Wall Street where mothers work 92% as many hours as fathers, but they only earn 53% as much money. However, the fathers, they work 90% as much as the childless men. And guess what? They earned more. They earned 122% as much money as a childless man. So, you know, I mean, there's the one of the differences that you can look forward to. interesting stuff. Men get second chances when they make mistakes. Women don't. The idea with a man is, yeah, he's going to go out and he's going to reach for it. He's going to take risks. And if he falls flat on his butt, dust him off, he's a good guy, he'll have another chance. A woman does the same, and it looks like she can't do it, she can't hack it, she hasn't got the right stuff, end of her promotions. She's got a flat line. Men are promoted on promise, and women are promoted on performance. So if you'll notice how many times, and we interviewed a lot of women for this book, the woman would say, God, I worked hard, I won awards, I did, you know, I performed brilliantly. And they hired this young guy, and they appointed him to the editorship or the partnership or whatever, and not me. And one woman that I know was promoted to was second in command of a large department in a newspaper. And after working brilliantly for 10 years, the senior editor left and hired a 24-year-old man. The woman was 38. And she went in and she said to him, why did you hire him? And the man said, he reminds me of me. So one of the big problems that women still have is, you know, it's hard because men still hold a lot of the hiring positions. They don't remind their boss of him when he was however many years old. If a woman works on a project with a man, he gets the credit even if she does all the work. Because the man is assumed, if there's a woman and a man, the man is assumed he's the leader, he's the person who's doing the work. One of the things that really struck me was that you are the stereotype. If people have no information about you, whether you're a man or a woman, you walk in the door, you are judged by the stereotype. Both men and women do this. So if a man walks in the door and he's reasonable looking and you know, not falling down on his face from having, you know, 18 beers, he is regarded as being forceful, active, a leader. If a woman walks in the door, she is regarded as being probably not too competent, probably not too smart, not committed to work, nice, but, you know, not anybody you'd really want to hire. I mean, if Sonia Sotomayor walked in the door and people did not know who she was, if she didn't say, I'm a Supreme Court Justice, if she did that, they'd say, ah, pretty good. But if she walked in and didn't give any information, she would be regarded as, hey, send her out for coffee. You know, she'll probably go. Whereas a man gets a free pass. And that's really interesting. So we are still fighting all the time. If you're a woman, you've got to keep saying, I did this, I did this, I did this, because nobody's going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And I think Betty Friedan would have, she'd really have understood that kind of action. And we talk about the glass ceiling. The glass ceiling isn't really the good image. What surprised Roz and I was the cumulative power of stereotypes over a woman's career. It's not like a woman gets in there, takes off for the skies, and runs into this barrier she hasn't seen. The real image is the hurdles. That from the beginning, there are a bunch of barriers that women don't see, and they can be knocked out of the race at any time. And so what you see is that when women are, when they're running this hurdle race, they're carrying this big backpack. The man is running, he's going over the hurdles pretty much unencumbered, and she is running with the backpack of all these discriminatory ideas that still are really there about women. And so no wonder that she's not going as far and as fast. And as for the end of men, by the way, the idea was that men are taking all the college seats, women are taking all the college seats and men are failing. The latest data shows that for white men and women of appropriate college age, the difference is 2%. Women occupy seats at a 2% a greater level than men. And I'll stop there.
Well, I want to begin with a confession. I was one of those young feminists who skipped Betty Friedan to go straight to No More Fun and Games and the Dialectic of Sex when I incorporated feminism into a new left politics that focused on race and class. My old Dell paperback edition dates from October 1972, so I must have read The Feminine Mystique in graduate school where I was at Brown. But I was a beneficiary of the social and cultural changes that Friedan charted and facilitated. My mom, however, was the unpaid vice president of my father's small business, and labored much longer and harder at home for the family and for Ralph Boris and Company. The problem that had an invisible name, the erasure of my mother's name on the company masthead, and the non-recognition of the worth of her labors. On the one hand, she was a negative model, doing for everybody without appreciation, you know. Oh, you can't do your hair right. You don't, you know, let me put the curlers in you. Okay. On the other hand, I learned that women could be competent, creative, and energetic, and actually more efficient than men. She knew how to make do, survival skills that historians associate with working class, African American, and immigrant women, which her mother was. Home and work. These are the themes of the feminine mystique, and it just so happens they happen to be the topics that have obsessed me for the last 30 or 40 years. Friedan saw too much home and not enough work, which she defined as employment, especially a career. I ask, how do we organize the making of people and their maintenance and the generating of income? And how do and should people combine the two? In looking at home labors, paid and unpaid, I've charted the centrality of housework and care work, reproductive labors, we might call them, to gender, class, and racial orders. Or if I want to be controversial, patriarchy, capitalism, and white supremacy. Now, in 1963, Friedan critiqued the happy housewife heroine, pointing to the quiet desperation of women through a constructed portrait of the modern American housewife. As the writings of historians were discovering the 19th century cult of domesticity, the home of the 1950s, in Friedan's book, appeared as a place of confinement. At one point, she even compares it to a concentration camp, the same analogy that Stanley Elkins was making for black slavery, the same moment. Friedan actually, as we know, captured the picture of some white middle-class women who, more than other women, were for a short time able to remain outside of the labor force and found paid work away from the home, maybe an attractive alternative to boredom within. These were the women whose access to education and other resources, including a white male wage, made it more likely that their work could be interesting and creative. But in trading in Freud for the philosophy of psychologist Abraham Maslow, I mean, she did do doctrinal work in psychology, Friedan neglected the lives of most women who, even in the 1950s and 1960s, found that they had to work, often part-time, at a job, not a profession, not for joy, but to make ends meet, to cement that middle-class lifestyle. What had changed from the early 20th century was not women's contribution to the family economy, but its location and form, from inside the home to outside, from services to wages. Now, I'm not going to exactly make the usual critique of Friedan, captured beautifully in a letter that historian Stephanie Kuntz has unearthed from the Friedan papers at Radcliffe, written by a civil rights left-wing housewife activist, someone also associated with the Communist Party, which Friedan was around. And this letter condemned Friedan's focus, quote, solely to the problem of middle-class college-educated women rather than, quote, working women, especially Negro women, who labor not only under the disadvantages imposed by the feminine mystique, but under the more pressing disadvantages of economic discrimination. The writer of that letter, the late Gerda Lerner, who had not yet become the pioneer in women's history that we all know her to be. Instead, I'm going to assert that Friedan learned the wrong lesson from the communist milieu that she was lived in the 1940s and early 1950s, a world of politics, ideas, and struggles, which, as Daniel Horowitz, another historian, has shown, she covered up to address other college-educated, white middle-class Smith graduates, and et cetera, as just another suburban housewife. That was her persona. She embraced the dictum of Frederick Engels in The Origins of the Family, Private Property in the State of 1884, in which Engels essentially said that the problem was that, quote, the modern individual family is founded on the open or concealed domestic slavery of the wife. And second, that If she carries out her duties in the private service of the family, she remains excluded from public production and unable to earn. And third, to quote Engels, the first condition for the liberation of the wife is to bring the whole female sex back into public industry. That is, women had to go out to work in order to join together in social struggle and work for the common good. But there was another communist analysis, one eventually embraced by sectors of women's liberation, but discredited by the Communist Party publicly and loudly during the time when Betty Friedan worked for the Federated Press and UE News. Mary Idman was a California activist. And in 1940, she came out with In Women's Defense, arguing that housework, like factory work, was productive labor. Like many Marxist feminist theorists of domestic labor some 30 years later, who debated whether housework produced use or exchange values, but I won't go into that right now. You'll fall asleep. But the point was, Inman claimed that it was the dissing of housework and the housewife, of child rearing and household maintenance. That's what led to women's subordination, not the economic function of the work itself that produced future and present labor power. That is, what did the housewife do? She socializes the children, she makes sure they're presentable, that they don't kill themselves because they have appropriate norms, the kind of maternal thinking that the late Sarah Ruddock talked about, and she makes sure that the worker, assumed as a male worker, can go out to work the next day by giving him sex and giving him food. So, it was reproductive labor. And indeed, this act, and so it was this acting out of this premise during the 1930s and beyond was part of the social struggles that women engaged in at the point of reproduction or consumption. Struggles over decent and affordable housing, the price of food, the quality of schools, community services, much as Friedan did when she moved to Parkway Village in Queens in the early 1950s. But the McCarthy years led to a focus on individual women, not collective demands, though education appeared as a safe arena for community activism in which she engaged in. And meanwhile, the Communist Party's mass women's organization of those years, the Congress of American Women, had by the late 40s focused on all this and more, on child care centers and maternity benefits, on anti-discrimination by race as well as sex. And Gerda Lerner was part of that struggle. Reproductive labors couldn't be done without social supports. Now, don't get me wrong. Friedan channeled the social science and historical insight that, as she put it, housewifery expands to fill the time available, as she put it, and that technology meant, as a later historian said, more work for mother. And it's hard to defend the routine cleaning, cooking, and diapering of domestic labor as anything but work that keeps on needing renewal. Indeed, in longing for an unalienated labor, Friedan has a utopian quality, shared by the autonomous work of Marxists today, who critique the equation of work as life and envision a realm of species being, that a realm of freedom. Nonetheless, Friedan's dismissal of housework had real consequences. And if you read over the Feminine Mystique, she refers to housework as something that an average or normal human intelligence doesn't do. It's equated with imbeciles and with people who don't have adult capacity. Well, if it isn't worthy of the intelligent woman, what are the implications for women who do housework, not out of love, but for money? Remember, African-American women still predominated in 1960 as the nation's cleaners, maids, and household workers. And today it is women of color, immigrant and US born, who, as one activist for decent work for domestics asserted, do the work in households that enables others to go out and be economically active. It is us who take care of your precious children and your sick and elderly. We cook your food to keep you healthy, and we look after your property when you are away. That is, we who are the oils in the world and the wheels of the global economy make work possible for other women.
As a woman in 1963 and someone who was active in SDS, in the anti-war movement, in the civil rights movement, and then the women's movement by the late 60s in New York, I never read Friedan. I never thought it was relevant. I thought that Friedan, in fact, was the problem that had a name. A kind of focus on the unhappiness of the white suburban housewife, as Eileen has said, and the need for an identity outside of motherhood. And I wasn't that. I was in a male-defined field. I actually have an undergraduate degree in industrial and labor relations, which, thank God, made me a labor historian. And my identity developed, frankly, as a movement person, as someone who was active in making change. I worked with women of color in my first job. I did political work. And I watched what those women did, and I found an identity. And my identity was in making the revolution and in being part of social change. And I grew up with a mother who raised four children but who worked as well. And so I thought Friedan had nothing to do with me. And so for me, and I think a number of women of my generation, 1963 was marked not by Friedan's book, but by the bombing in September of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham and the killing of four young girls. And then, of course, by November that year, the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the beginnings of the escalation of the Vietnam War. So it was those events, I think, that shaped the feminists of my generation, of the socialist feminism that I was part of, and the need to see institutional solutions and organized ways of going about it. And our identities were forged within the civil rights movement and the radical and anti-war movements of the 60s. So even if you're being drawn into the women's movement through consciousness-raising groups in the late 60s, I actually didn't even still see the relevance of Friedan. And in fact, when I taught her briefly when I got to Wellesley to teach women's studies, I thought of her as providing what you call in biology the founder effect. That is, in genetics, when a newly formed colony is small, its founder can affect the entire population well into the future because that gene pool gets reproduced in very small numbers. That was the problem for us of Friedan. The way in which feminism became associated with the problem of only one group of people and the assumption that work, in fact, would be the solution turned out to be a problem. And in fact, when I was at Wellesley, the first thing I had to do, I think the second year I was there, the president asked me to give a speech to the incoming first years, this is 1983, called Feminism, What's in a Name? And why did we need this terminology any longer? Given what Carol's talking about, it's really interesting to think about it. But I think what the problem was that Friedan founder's effect was that the women's movement and the idea of feminism then became labeled as a very narrow terminology, and most of us have spent the rest of our professional and political careers trying to overcome that perception. And Friedan gets caught up in the attack on lesbians, for example, in the 70s when she talked about the lavender menace. And so the problem became explaining the mystique about the mystique, actually. Friedan became the problem that had a name and that we had to, in fact, deal with it. On the other hand, the key thing that she did, and as someone who spends a lot of time talking to my students about this, if you don't know there's a problem and you cannot describe it, then there can be no political work around it. And so what Friedan did for us was to give it a name. And that, I think, is the genius, essentially, of the work. So as a historian thinking back on this, we now know from the work that's done biographically on Lean suggested this, that Friedan, like, if you think about it, the way the women who tell women not to work and go back to home, of course, are speaking publicly. So if you think about Phyllis Schlafly telling everybody to go back to work while she's busy working, Friedan, in some ways, is similar. That is, Friedan's moaning about an explanation of what was going on in the suburbs was not her own history in any way, and we know that now from the really wonderful biographies that have now been written, and Eileen's talked about this, so I won't go into it a lot, and we know a lot more about what was going on in her own personal life, and she reflected, and it's too bad, actually, that she didn't write more about it, about the tension that actually goes on in a household when two people are actually trying to take care of both children and move on in their own careers, that affects lesbian couples and trans couples as much as it affects male and female couples. It is about how are we going to organize all of this. So I'll, so in a sense, I think what happened is that she didn't give us a strong enough history of what was going on, but we should, in fact, use the book, and I think as a historical text. Now, I think we should understand it in the light of the new biographies to give us a sense of what she didn't do and did do, and it's really interesting to think about why, in fact, that happened. That is, why did she make this particular political move at that point to try to explain it in this way, and why have we all spent our lives, in fact, dealing with that issue. But I think what she did name for us is what I would think of as the unfinished business of the women's movement in many ways. That is, the definitions of what counts as masculinity and femininity, the limitations of that as a binary that I think is very much still at work. The unfinished business of work and family conflict, which she alluded to but never really talked about. And for her, the solution was to see women as full human beings, to use Maslow's ideas about needs as a way to understand that, and the limitations I think we've all learned about why education itself is not the answer, and the structural reasons that this oppression continues has to be really fully realized and discussed, and it has to be done, as Eileen has said, across the world and for every woman that exists, and every man as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just going to make a few comments of reflection on this book. Throughout my academic career, I've been very interested in the confluence of historical time and biographical time. How do we understand history and the movements of events and of culture and of societies? And how do we understand our own biographies and how those come together? Where we step into that larger river, and if you listen carefully, you can really detect the different ways we stepped into that river. And then as you go through both your life and historical time, how your perspective on both changes. And I would say very strongly that when I first became involved in the feminist movement and in beginning to think as a pre-scholar about gender and women's issues, Betty Friedan was completely irrelevant to me. She really meant nothing. I was the college class of 1972, and I know very well that I read Shulamit Firestone first. I read Sheila Robotham first. I read, probably in graduate school, my colleague is a graduate student, Gail Rubin, first. And so the kinds of things you can tell that Eileen and I stepped into the river roughly at the same time, because the language that I used at that point was the labor of reproductive labor and really thinking about those categories, about what do we think work is and what do we think relationships are. When I encountered that book, what I saw was not anything that was terribly relevant to me. I saw my mother, somebody who was well-educated and stepped into suburban Connecticut, married to a madman, to raise her children, me and my younger sister, in Mad Men, and where I saw tremendous frustration and anger that, frankly, I thought was my fault throughout our childhood, my childhood, and her being my mother. And it took until I was an adult and gained some historical, as opposed to just autobiographical knowledge, to begin to see something very different. And so for me, the book, The Feminine Mystique, meant a couple of things. One was, eventually, it became an insight into those women who raised us and into what I saw. It was the beginning of data. Some of the things she did about the mass media and so forth, as Carol pointed out, were fabulous. I mean, really paying attention to what the public images were of women and men, especially in the 1950s. And she did one other thing for me. That phrase, the problem that has no name, I didn't recognize that other than seeing my mother later. But I did very soon find a problem that had no name, when we began to give a name to what was happening to us as young women students in the academy in the early 1970s, and that was sexual harassment. We had no name for that, for those of you who were younger. There was nothing to call the use of sexuality as power against somebody who was more vulnerable. It didn't have a name. What that was is, it must have been something I did. It must have been something I said. Added to, and I thought, he thought I was a brilliant student. And I found there was something else he liked better. So the problem that had no name also became something that I think a lot of us were able to generalize as we continued through women's studies, gender studies, sexuality studies, to understand what, as we said then, the power of naming meant, what it meant when we didn't have a name for something we experienced, and what it meant as those names and those identifications morphed over time. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is very important. And I think what I would say about that period is that it is true that Betty Friedan was only talking about certain people. And I dare say, as a social scientist, that either most of us who are academics are only talking about certain people, although we better be conscious of who we're talking about. Because if we're talking really about all people, we have probably just homogenized them, and we fall back into talking only about some people. So who was Betty Friedan talking about? She was dealing with a very particular historical period. The 1950s is brief. It looks very brief now. But if you look at all the indicators of women's status through the beginning of the 20th century, you see that through the early 20th century, and certainly pushed by the Great Depression, you see women becoming a larger percentage of those who are becoming educated at every level. You see women entering the labor force in ways they hadn't earlier. You see women entering the labor force in a variety of different kinds of jobs they hadn't entered before, although certain kinds of labor jobs stayed very, very closed to women. And so you see this rise. World War II happens. And then you get things like what I quoted at the very beginning of explaining this disjuncture, this unhappiness. Women, go back and raise your children. We needed a population after the war. We needed to deal with the burgeoning service sector and the large growing healthcare and education sector. And so for that period of time, where the middle class is regarded as an advance guard, listen to President Obama, he's saying the same thing, the advance guard that is going to lead to economic and social growth during that period, those are the women she was thinking about, the Smith graduates like her, who were supposed to have one kind of life but didn't. So yes, she was only talking about some people who lived at that period. She was not very interesting to some of us who came later until we gained some historical viewpoint. And then I would just close by saying that the women's movement at that period was much more complex and much more diverse than it's given credit for. Let me close with this. So you know your click moments. Here's mine. I'm sitting at Clark University. It's May 1970. We are on strike. And we have, it's a little school, so we can all fit into one auditorium this size. And we get up to have our platform about how we're going to change the world and have a revolution. Wonderful. We were all 18, 19, 20. So we were at that point going to bring the war to a screeching halt and just change the world. So one speaker got up to the front and said, okay, the first plank we're going to have is that we are going to recognize the racism on our campus, in Massachusetts, in the world, and we are going to dedicate ourselves to fighting racism. And everybody cheered and, you know, yes, yes, and we all voted that we were going to end racism right there. And then somebody else got up and said, and the second plank is we are going to end the imperialism of the American state. And, you know, and we're going to recognize the imperialism on our campus and in Massachusetts. And in the United States and in the world, and we're going to fight to end it. We're going to, yes, yes, yay, yay, we're going to do that. And then the next person got up and said, and we are going to recognize the class oppression on our campus, you got it, in Massachusetts, in the world, and we are going to fight to end class oppression. Everybody stands up. And then someone I found very annoying from one of my classes, who was constantly in my political theory class talking about women in this thing, the National Organization of Women or something, whatever it was, and she embarrassed me because, of course, women were fine. But she constantly, well, what did Plato say about women? And she got up in front of everybody, and she said, and we are going to recognize the sexism, I winced, the sexism on our campus in Massachusetts and in the world. And there was silence. And I looked to my left and right. I was sitting, of course, only among men. And I looked, and they started laughing. And I looked around the room, and they started laughing. And we were going to stop all these other things, but sexism was really funny. And I found myself, May something or other, 1970, driven to stand up, and I was about here, so it was a long auditorium, to stand up, excuse myself from the row, and I was propelled down the aisle, out the back, because my stomach was turning, and she no longer was embarrassing me. I didn't belong there. And as I stood up and walked down the row, 30 other women did exactly the same thing. I'm going to leave it there, and I want to thank my fellow panelists here.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a panel discussion presented by the Boston University College of Arts and Sciences celebrating the 50th anniversary of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. Our panelists included University of California professor Eileen Boris, Wellesley College professor Susan Reverby, Boston University professor Carol Rivers, and Brandeis University resident scholar Roberta Salper. Our moderator was Virginia Sapiro, professor of political science and dean of Boston University's College of Arts and Sciences. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.